Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, depending on where you're at. This is the Spingola Zone. It is Monday, May 12, 2014. This is Deanna Spingola. This weekly program is sponsored by the American Free Press, whose website is AmericanFreePress.net. I have been a subscriber to both the American Free Press and the Barnes Review, whose website is BarnesReview.org. Please visit both websites. My websites are Spingola.com and SpingolaSpeaks.wordpress.com, and the latter website is one that one of our listeners created, and I thank him very much for doing that. He makes the audio files available there. And anyway, we have a very special guest today, and that guest is Kelly Patricia O'Meara. She is the author of Psyched Out: How Psychiatry Sells Mental Illness and Pushes Pills That Kill. Kelly, welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Deanna.
Well, thank you for joining me. And I forgot to mention, too, that people can join us in the chat room, spingola.chatango.com. Well, tell us what provoked you to write this book. You had written articles previous to that, which I think I have found all of them on the internet and have read them. But tell us what provoked you to write this book and when.
As you say, I wrote many, many articles about psychiatric diagnosing and psychiatric drugs when I was a reporter at the Washington Times Insight magazine. In fact, the first article I ever wrote was called Guns and Doses, the Common Link in High School Shootings, Maybe Psychotropic Drugs, like Ritalin. It was because of that first article that I went on to write 2,000 others during my time there about psychiatry and the fraud of psychiatric diagnosing as it is presented to the public today. And even at that time, now that's, well, I was in 1999, I wrote that article. I can't believe it's been that long since I've been covering this issue. But after I left Insight, I was, you know, very passionate about this issue. I believe that informed consent is necessary. It's a must. And I didn't believe that people were getting all the information that they needed to make informed decisions. So I kind of took the information that I had gained during my reporting of it at the Times, and decided to write a book.
Super. Now, informed consent is a term that we have heard before on this program, because I've had Sheila Matthews on the program, and she talks about informed consent and has been trying for about as long as you have to inform people about what is in the psychiatric drugs. And it just seems it is an uphill battle. And for a lot of reasons. And you talk. I love the introduction to your book. I think everyone should buy a copy of this book. It is absolutely wonderful. I rarely read a book twice. I have read it twice. I got something more out of the second time through. Just the author's note at the beginning of the book is worth buying the book for. I mean, it is so concise and just tells it like it is, and it's just amazing.
I appreciate that. Thank you. I hope that everyone will buy the book, and I think it's easy to read. It certainly goes over most of the issues that people need to know about as far as the psychiatric drugs, the black box warnings associated with them, the adverse effects, and of course, the fraud of psychiatric diagnosing as a biological disease. It is not, has never been, and you know, who knows when it may be, I don't know, but the fact is, mental health and psychiatry tend to sell it as a mental disorder is a biological disease, and that simply isn't so. It's wrong. That's false information. It's not.
Absolutely. And we have been led to believe that it is. And, of course, they use the DSM, which I guess the first one came out in 1952, and the latest one was version 5. And they have all of these diseases, what they call diseases, which are not based on any lab tests, on anything biological. If you get to, if you have something else wrong with you, an actual physical issue, they take blood tests. If you have diabetes, they can check your blood and they can tell you, okay, this is what's going on. But this is just all nonsense. It's just
behavior.
Yes,
it's
behavior.
It's behavior. And even the DSM has a caveat in the beginning of the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Illnesses and Mental Disorders. You know, I mean, basically they're telling you that it's not biological right at the beginning of the book. So from there on out, really, you know, everything else is just sort of their understanding of your behavior. So all of these alleged mental disorders, they are not an objective, confirmable abnormality. That's
right.
What science and medicine requires, an objective, confirmable abnormality. And it's been repeated. I have been on hundreds of radio shows. You know, I've written it. Many people have. I'm not, you know, the only person to be out there trying to make people aware. Now, this is not to say that people are not suffering, that they don't get depressed, truly, you know, depressed, that they don't experience emotional and behavioral problems. I have never said that, and I never would. But I don't think that it's appropriate to mislead people into believing that their behavioral and emotional problems are due to a biological cause. That has not been established in medicine or science yet.
Right. And it's amazing when you read about how they devise all of these so-called diseases, is that a bunch of psychiatrists get together in a room and they suggest different kinds of things, and there's some of them are so silly. I mean, it's just absolutely ridiculous. I guess the first
they vote them into existence. Literally, they sit around a table in their groups, depending on what they're considering to be the next mental disorder, or change the mental disorder that's already in the DSM. And it's really by a show of hands whether it's going to get into the DSM or not. It's not based on scientific data. It's not based on medicine. It's not based on, and I have to keep repeating this throughout the show so that I hope it sinks in. It's not based on an objective, confirmable abnormality. In other words, let's take, for instance, you break your leg. You take an x-ray, looks like that bone is broken, and then the next doctor can take another x-ray and go, yep, it's confirmed. Yep, we have a broken leg. You know, so we don't have that in psychiatry. Psychiatric diagnoses are basically a collection of understandings of people's behavior.
Right.
And you could go to one psychiatrist and he may diagnose you with depression, and go to another one who may say, you have ADHD or you have anxiety, so take this drug and this drug. I mean, there's no science behind it, and that's what people need to understand.
Sure. And as you say, these are behaviors, and these are behaviors that we've all experienced. We all get sad. We all get happy. We get depressed because that's what life brings us. When my mother died back in 2005, I just happened to be visiting the doctor, and I don't visit the doctor much anymore. I mentioned that my mother had passed away, and she immediately said, oh, do you need something for depression? And I said, well, no. This is something that I don't need a pill. I need to feel how I feel. And it was just amazing that she was really quick to to take out her prescription pad.
Right, and you need to grieve, and there's no time limit on grieving. That's the other very strange thing in the DSM-5 now. If you grieve longer than the American Psychiatric Association thinks you should grieve, then you have a mental disorder, and I assume there are antidepressants that they'll prescribe to take care of that, which is sort of odd. Everybody grieves in their own way and in their own time, and I hardly think that the APA can set a limit on it.
Sure. Now, that is the American Psychiatric Association is the one that publishes, produces the DSM, the Diagnostic Manual of Statistics, and of course, there aren't any statistics in the DSM. What is the principal reason that they decided to create this manual? What does it have to do with insurance?
Well, in today's world, in order to get reimbursed for mental disorders, especially with the new parity laws, mental health parity, you have to be able to diagnose based on the DSM criteria to get paid. It's all often been referred to as the billing Bible of psychiatry. And that's, it's necessary to have. Although I did read it, in getting ready for the show and prepping for it, I was actually going through the DSM, the old DSM, the DSM-4R. I can't afford the new DSM.
Yeah, I didn't want to buy it either. I just thought, no,
it's like
I'm not going to give it money. How
yeah,
much?
It's like $600. It's ridiculous. It says in there that these aren't even supposed to be used for legal purposes, which I thought was sort of interesting. Anyway, it's referred to as the billing Bible of psychiatry so that they can get reimbursed, doctors can get reimbursed when they diagnose for depression and they prescribe whatever psychiatric drug they're going to prescribe.
Exactly. And the funny thing about, well, not funny, but they will not pay for talk therapy. But they will pay for a med session where all the psychiatrist does is say, well, how are you doing? Are you sleeping okay? Okay. We'll just keep you on that drug then. And
exactly.
Yeah. So talk to us about that.
Well, I mean, in psychiatry therapy, it's expensive in a sort of relative way. It's certainly more expensive than just handing out pills. I think that one of the things that is troublesome in psychiatry, in mental health treatment today, is that there's very little compassion. And when I say compassion, I think of people who are suffering from depression in their lives for whatever reason. They don't have anyone to turn to talk to. They don't want to talk to their family or friends. So they need somebody to kind of dump their baggage on, I guess, is how I'd put it.
Sure.
And somebody to listen who's an uninterested party. And that is a good thing about therapy, I would suggest. But it's expensive. And so insurance companies are more apt not to pay for therapy and go for the drugs, because in the long term they're less expensive.
Wow. Wow. And, of course, the doctor, the psychiatrist, makes a lot more money dishing out pills than sitting and chatting with somebody for an hour. They can see maybe four or five people in that hour and make a lot more money.
Exactly. It's much easier. And again, you think about it, this is a diagnosis that has far-reaching effects, and it's done in a very short amount of time. Once you get the diagnosis and they write the script, you are now on mind-altering drugs. And I mean that in the very real sense of these drugs will change your brain chemicals. Your chemistry. It will change your brain chemistry. You know, say you're out of your mind. Well, literally, you are out of your mind now.
Right.
Because, you've just done something to your brain where you're inserting, foreign chemicals. And I don't know that people really sort of understand it. Of course, we've all lived with the chemical imbalance theory, which is just, I'm over it. Are you over it, Deanna? I'm over it. I don't want to hear it anymore.
Oh.
It is a theory. It has been out there so long. And what people don't understand is if doctors are still saying to you that your depression may be due to a chemical imbalance, the first thing out of your mouth has to be, really, what test did you do that you measured my chemicals in my brain? They didn't do any tests because there's no test available to even test your brain chemicals. Worse still is that nobody knows what normal brain chemical levels are for anyone.
Right. They could be independent. It could be just an independent kind of thing. Some people have,
That's right. We're all different, okay? So the fact that they keep bringing this, maybe due to a chemical imbalance, I'm over it. Stop it. It is a theory that has been around too long. It has never been proven. And it is simply misinformation as far as I'm concerned at this point.
Sure. But it sounds, look at how many millions of people have bought into that theory. And I have friends that have believed that, have gone on Prozac. And in fact, I have a friend who was on Prozac, and for a number of years, she tried to get off of it, finally got off of it. And I think that it really did change her. I think it does something to the frontal lobe of your brain. It does alter you. These mind-altering drugs alter your mind. Anyway, she was off of this Prozac for probably 2 years. She seemed happy. She seemed okay. But then she started becoming, kind of paranoid, kind of just a lot of issues, just a lot of real big issues. Then her family convinced her, you need to go back on a drug. So she went on Abilify. She stopped seeing all of her friends. She stopped taking calls. She stopped interacting with people. She's become incredibly isolated. It's horrible. These drugs have destroyed her life.
Right, and that's a story that you hear repeatedly over when if you cover it like I do, and certainly you know yourself, when you start interviewing people who have been on these for a long time, their life has, for all intent and purposes, gone down the toilet, and they're just barely hanging on. They started off on one mind-altering drug, and then that didn't work, so they upped it, and that didn't work, and so, they added another one, and that didn't work. I mean, it's an endless cycle.
Sure.
And unfortunately, it's starting to be cradle to grave. I mean, we have 2-year-olds in this country who are on antidepressants. I mean, talk about crazy. It's insane to even think that anybody would think that's okay.
Right. When I had Dr. Linda Loggeman on the program, I've had her on a few times. She's wonderful. And I think the first time that she was on the program, she said that there are 280,000 children, infants, in this country who have been prescribed these antidepressant drugs, antipsychotic drugs. And they are age under 12 months. Under 12
right.
months. This is criminal, in my opinion. This is criminal on the doctor's part. It is absolute stupidity on the parent's part. What in heaven's name are they thinking?
Yeah, I would agree with you. I think at this point it is criminal. What people don't understand is that it's become a psych drug nation. We have become a psych drug nation. 79 million Americans are taking at least one psychiatric drug. Just one, okay? At least. They might be taking five, but at least one. And that's 41 million of those people are taking antidepressants. Almost 8 million of that 41 million are teenagers, are children between the ages of 6 and 17. I mean, those are astounding numbers to think of people who are taking these mind-altering drugs.
And,
okay.
Yeah, and many of them are prescribed by the family doctor.
Most prescribing today is done by family physicians. Most of the psychiatric drugging today is done by family physicians. It's not done by psychiatrists, which is sort of interesting in and of itself. So medicine, real medicine, has bought into, to psychiatry. And I don't know if behind that is money-driven part of it or what, but I find that very interesting. The point is, where do you stop? At what point does medicine and psychiatry, you know, look at what they're doing and go, wait, we're diagnosing everyone with a mental illness. And then we're giving them drugs that actually change the chemicals in their mind, in their brain.
And actually create the mental illness. You quote in the beginning of your book, you quote Dr. Bragdon, who is just fabulous. I've purchased a bunch of his books also.
Dr. Bragdon, I'm a big fan of Dr. Bragdon. He's just really a great, great, great guy and a wonderful psychiatrist who understands what's going on.
Right. And he didn't, he has courage because he went against the typical mentality of other psychiatrists. So I just think he has courage. He found out the truth. Now he's standing up, and he has testified in many, many court cases. He has also testified before Congress. In fact, he testified before Congress, I think, a couple of years ago about the military situation, all the suicides in the military. He's just fabulous, absolutely wonderful. And you do quote him in your book. Let me just find it. It's right at the beginning of the book. And he says, ironically, psychiatric drugs cause, rather than cure, biochemical imbalances in the brain. In fact, the only known biochemical imbalances in the brain of patients routinely seen by psychiatrists are brought about by the psychiatrists themselves through the prescription of mind-altering drugs. Psychiatric drugs work precisely by causing imbalances in the brain, by producing enough brain malfunction to dull the emotions and judgment or to produce an artificial high. And they are the problem. So you might not even have this big major problem. You may just be a little sad, but by the time you get on these drugs, you provide stories, testimonies from the 1991 hearing about people who have killed themselves within days.
Yeah, you know, Deanna, were you at that hearing?
No.
I was actually at that hearing. And I'm glad you brought that up because I think the American people have to understand when the FDA holds hearings like the hearings in 1991, which were about putting black box warnings on the antidepressants, okay, to watch a room, to be in a room full of parents who have lost their children or their loved one, okay, a spouse, because of these drugs, and it's very clear that this happened after they were put on these drugs, but they're standing there holding poster-sized pictures of their, you know, 12-year-old beautiful daughter who hung herself in the closet. I mean, it's tragic. It's just awful to stand and watch it, and then to think that this committee is, you know, they're going to, you know, mull it over and think about it. And, you know, I mean, this takes a lot of guts for these families to go to the FDA and say, look, you know, we're going to stand up and talk about this. And I think at that first session, they weren't even going to vote on it. They were going to think about it. Even after they heard all this testimony from, you know, dozens of people.
Right.
So it was really emotional.
Yes. Well, by that time, there were 170 court cases against Eli Lilly.
Eli Lilly was the first to bring out an SSRI, the serotonin selective reuptake inhibitors, which we all know is Prozac. It was the first of its class. And, you know, just the process of that being approved in and of itself is an interesting story.
Oh, yes. I've read John, I can't ever think of his last name, the guy that used to work for Eli Lilly. He was in charge of sales and Viaprin, or I think that's his name, John Viaprin. And he wrote Side Effects Death, which is a very good read. And, I mean, he told about the process. They literally bought their way into by paying off doctors to recommend this. I mean, it was just awful. Awful the way that they got this approved.
Peter Bragdon actually was one of the first people to see the actual documents that were brought up during a court case. I think it was the Westbecker case.
Yes, yeah.
And he actually saw the Eli Lilly documents where they're communicating with the physicians in Germany about suicides and so forth. What people don't understand is that when a drug is approved by the FDA, specifically when a mind-altering psychiatric drug is approved, or they're trying to get approval, the FDA requires two clinical trials that are positive or statistically significant difference between the pill and the placebo. And what they don't understand, what people don't understand, is that a pharmaceutical company may conduct 48 clinical trials, and 38 of them fail, but two of them are statistically significant. Well, the drug can be approved, despite the fact that the other 38 failed.
Wow.
I mean, that's how bizarre it is.
Right. And, of course, they stack these trials with people who they want to produce the correct results, and a lot of people will not who are depressed, who they bring into the trials, have hope. And so they are really looking at thinking that this drug is going to help them. And they also use placebos. And in the trials themselves, the placebos were more beneficial than the drug.
Yeah, that came out in a book called The Emperor's New Drugs, I believe. He actually got all the clinical trial data, I mean all of it, for the major antidepressants and looked at it. In fact, the first time he got done and he saw his analysis, he thought it was wrong. He just couldn't believe that this was accurate. So he actually spent a long time doing it again because he didn't believe his first results. And what he came up with was, I think he called it the placebo effect, that there was any statistical difference at all. It was because of the placebo. But anyway, I mean, the fact of the matter is clinical trials are very short. They may last 6 weeks, and there are very few people involved in clinical trials. So when I look at the public being on all these mind-altering drugs, right now we have, you know, 79 million Americans taking at least one psychiatric drug. I look at the public and I go, you're in a third clinical trial.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. You're the guinea pigs.
Yeah, you're the guinea pigs. The clinical trials that we looked at to approve the drug, we only saw two. And they were very, very small sample of people for a very, very short period of time. So we're going to approve it, and then we're going to send it out to the public, and then we'll wait and see. The thing is that people have the ability, and I want to bring this up because I think it's important, and I even think Abel Child, who you mentioned earlier, is fighting for some legislation in Connecticut to get the MedWatch system incorporated into training in Connecticut.
Right.
And I think this is important, and it should be nationwide, that the public should be more fully aware of the FDA's MedWatch system, because what that does is give you an 800 number, or you can go to the website, the FDA website, and you can fill out a form. It's all private. It's not shared with anybody except the FDA. And it's not, you know, person-specific. In other words, they don't want to know all your personal information. They want to know what your adverse reaction to a drug was.
Right.
Okay. So if you have an adverse reaction, they want to know what it was. And based on information that the FDA gets from MedWatch, then they can decide if they need to alert doctors that there may be a problem. They may make labeling changes to the drug, or they could even pull the drug from the market if they get so many adverse reaction reports. And it's very, very important for people to know that's available and they can utilize it themselves. They don't need to go to their doctor, you know, they don't need to go to a pharmacy. They can just go online or call the 800 number. So I think that's important for people to understand, because the FDA wants that information.
There is just a revolving door with the FDA and the pharmaceutical company. Like they could, a person could work in the FDA, be an official in the FDA, and if they are very acquiescent to the pharmaceutical industry, they are pretty much guaranteed a plush, high-paying job when they leave the FDA, or if a pharmaceutical company hires them away from the FDA. Correct?
Uh-huh. Right, exactly. Oh, it's totally a revolving door. And that's true in other agencies, too, but in the FDA, one of the biggest problems with the FDA is that the pharmaceuticals contribute to the FDA financially. Okay, in other words, Congress doesn't fund the FDA completely. So the FDA receives funding, some funding, from the pharmaceutical industry, and I think that has to stop. That's a clear conflict.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
So,
and
yeah.
And, of course, the American Psychiatric Association gets funding from the pharmaceutical industry. A lot of the groups, like CHAD, gets funding from the pharmaceutical industry.
NAMI,
the National Institute of Mental Health. I mean, that was really created by the American Psychiatric Association, correct?
Yeah.
Go ahead, talk to us about that.
We do. I mean, groups like NAMI are funded by the pharmaceuticals. An interesting thing, again, I have to bring up, I've been watching this group, Able Child. And last week there was a tete-a-tete between a member of NAMI in some op-ed articles up in Connecticut, in the Connecticut Mirror. And this NAMI person was writing saying that, you know, psychiatric diagnoses, you know, are real biological diseases. And Able Child was providing all this information, obviously, that says, no, it's not, and here's the proof, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was sort of interesting that they're still passing this false information about the diagnosis that it's really a disease, when in fact, if you go to the National Institute of Mental Health website and you just look up, like, let's look up just depression or bipolar disorder or ADHD, even schizophrenia, okay? None of them in their discussion do they say that they are biological in nature.
Right.
Okay, they don't know what causes these alleged mental illnesses. So for NAMI or CHAD or any of the mental health organizations to continue to say this, it is simply misinformation.
Right.
And it plays into, you know, their support of the pharmaceutical industry. You gotta have a biological cause. It has to be real so that people believe that the drugs they're taking will actually treat this abnormality, when in fact, Deanna, if you look at the drug, you know, approvals on the FDA website when they're approved, you know, they're very lawyerly. And even the drug companies admit they don't know how these drugs work in the brain.
Yeah.
So it's a double-edged sword. It's, we don't know what causes the mental illness, and then we don't know how the drugs work in the brain to treat that mental illness.
But go ahead and take them anyway, because we're making a lot of money. That's what they might as well finish it up with.
Exactly. When in fact, all we have to say, we don't know what causes it, and we don't know how these drugs work. Just be honest.
Yeah.
Sure. But again, you know, they're showing themselves as a real, you know, this is a real medical, you know, abnormality. They have to. And it's not true.
Right. I was reading about the National Institute of Mental Health that they are actually conducting some of the trials now. So the institute was set up as a government agency. So basically what they are saying and what they are implying is that it's a taxpayer who is now funding clinical trials so that the drug companies don't have to pay for them. Correct?
Okay, yeah, but this is new. I did not know that NIM was actually conducting the clinical trials for the pharmaceuticals. I did not know that.
Let's see, where did I read? I think I read that in Dr. Bragan's book, Talking Back to Ritalin. I believe
are
that's what I noted. Pardon?
Are they funding it, or are they actually conducting the clinical trials?
They are actually conducting some of the clinical trials now.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's interesting. You just informed me of something I didn't know.
And in 2009, and the book that I read it in came out in 2009, so I think it's Talking Back to Ritalin, he said they were getting ready to conduct these trials on the age group 2 to 6 years old, which just made me just furious. Absolutely. I was so mad. I just see all of these precious little children being criminally assaulted with chemicals.
Yeah, the thing, what you have to understand is that Bragan has done such really, really good work, and in all his books, which I've read all of them, and he's just a wealth of information. And one of the quotes in his book, I don't remember which book it was, it says, despite 6 decades of research, the Food and Drug Administration approved labels for stimulants, which is the drugs that are treatment for ADHD.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the FDA is required to state, and this is a quote, long-term effects of amphetamines in children have not been well established, unquote. In other words, we don't know what the long-term effect of these drugs on your kids is. And to this day, after 6 decades of research, they still don't know. But go ahead and take these drugs, kids. Go ahead and take methylphenidate, which is a Schedule II, the closest thing that we have to cocaine. Go ahead and take this every day for years. We don't know what the long-term effect is, but it'll help you. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Of course it is. And it's really people control. You mentioned this throughout your book. It's really to control children rather than improve the school system, have more informative teachers. It's really about controlling behavior in the school system. And go ahead.
It's about control, period. And I don't understand... Personally, after researching this issue for 15 years, I still don't understand the public's desire to let go of the control of their life to psychiatry and psychiatric drugs. I don't understand that. Is it because it's easier? Is it because they believe what they're being told, even though it's misinformation? I don't know the answer to that, other than if you say it enough, people believe it, and I think that's part of it. Certainly was with the chemical imbalance. I mean, they just said that over and over and over again. In fact, Zoloft, their commercial with the little bouncing ball,
mm-hmm.
You remember that?
Yes.
That it may be due to a chemical imbalance and a little ball, you know, he's bouncing on the screen, so everybody sort of got it. Oh, well, it could be because I have a chemical imbalance.
Sure.
You know, the fact is, the reason that they use the word may, that's a lawyerly word, may. It may be due to. Okay, they
mm-hmm.
can't get sued, say it is due to. They said it may be. Well, it may not be, too.
Right.
You know, the other side of it, it may not be.
Right.
So,
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, go ahead, go ahead.
It's very interesting to me that even in 1991, that there was no mention in any news reports about this hearing. Nobody mentioned anything about it. And it's because the pharmaceutical industry had such control over Congress, over the corporate media. And now, since 1997... you have direct-to-consumer advertising, which has increased prescription usage by, 300% or something, because mm-hmm. people now see these commercials and they think, then they run to their doctor and they say, oh, I saw an ad about Abilify. Do you think that would help me? Well, of course, mm-hmm. the doctor's going to write a prescription for it, because the doctors get kickbacks for writing these prescriptions. Everybody's on the payroll.
I think that's a very good issue to talk about, and that is the fact that we do have the direct consumer advertising for pharmaceuticals. We're the only nation in the world now that allows that. In fact, New Zealand used to be the only other nation that did, and they stopped it. I think it's time to reconsider that, what the long-term harmful effects of that kind of advertising is on the public. You know, they took away alcohol commercials and cigarette commercials, and I think it's time to have a conversation about that.
Exactly. Well, there's an attorney that that wrote the foreword to Talking Back to Ritalin. The attorney's name is Dick Scruggs. Do you remember him? He was part of a consortium of attorneys that went after the tobacco industry, especially for their insidious advertising to children. You know, you had the Joe Camel and all this advertising that was very, very appealing to children and adolescents. And then the cigarette industry, tobacco industry, would pass out a lot of free cigarettes to the military. And then he compares this to the pharmaceutical industry, where you also have people, doctors saying, here, try this. This is a free sample. Try this. But he said that it's that the advertising in the pharmaceutical industry is far more insidious, and the objectives are the same because they are trying to get young people on a drug such as Ritalin. And once you get on a drug, you're going to be on a drug for the rest of your life because...
Yeah, it's cradle to grave. Cradle to grave.
Yes, absolutely. And I thought, yeah, but the thing that he pointed out, which I thought was really significant, he said, people recognize that smoking is bad for you. But when it's introduced as, oh, this is for your health, this is medication, this will help you. And it's totally different when you introduce it as a medicine instead of
right.
as something bad. And that is terrible, terrible, terrible.
Right. And again, I think it's a conversation that we need to have as a nation. Is it time to stop this kind of advertising on television?
Sure.
The numbers, people now on psychiatric drugs are just, you know, skyrocketing. And there's lots of adverse reactions that come with these drugs, and I'm sure we'll get into that during the show, but
sure.
It's time to have that conversation.
Well, speaking of adverse reactions, you give several examples from the 1991 hearings, and I mean, when you think of the recalls that people have, that the FDA has made on beef or on some other product, I mean, there's an immediate recall if somebody gets sick and gets food poisoning in some restaurant in Idaho or somewhere, they immediately have this recall. But here, you have provided, from the hearing, there were people who committed suicide, like Del Shannon. He committed suicide within 2 weeks after taking Prozac, and his wife was there at the hearing. There should have been a recall on Prozac immediately following that hearing. And yet it took, 13 years before they had, till 2003 that they conducted another hearing, and they only did that because the British had decided, we're going to ban these things. SSRI antidepressants are terrible. So go ahead and tell us about that.
Well, remember at the time, this is what's really interesting too. At that time, the antidepressants had not been approved for use in children. And yet, physicians and psychiatrists were prescribing these mind-altering drugs off-label. In other words, the FDA approves drugs for a certain age group, for a certain diagnosis. And at that time, they were not approved for children. So the doctors have the ability to go, no, I think this would help, so I'm going to go ahead and prescribe it. So there was all this prescribing going on off-label for these antidepressants. And remember, all the parents that stood up in those hearings and talked about their kids and what happened to them, gut-wrenching, totally gut-wrenching. I think that the FDA, I agree with you, and I think I wrote about it in my book, only put the black box warnings on the antidepressants because the British beat them to it. The British actually did. Their equivalent of the FDA said, this is bad. We're going to stop this.
Right.
And I think they were pressured into it. Our FDA was pressured into it by another, you know, drug regulatory agency, which is sad. This is so sad that it took that for them to finally, you know, take action.
Right.
And their job is to protect the consumer. That, you know, that's what's so irritating. Their job is to protect the consumer. There have been 14,000 adverse reactions reported to the FDA for psych drugs, okay? And you would think, wow, 14,000.
And those are just the people that reported.
Exactly. And again, the FDA admits that only 1% of the actual adverse reactions are reported. So, you know, this is a problem. You go, well, why are they still allowing these drugs on the market if this is the kind of numbers they're getting back? Remember Fen-Phen, the diet pill that, you know, women were dying from heart attacks?
Right.
Okay?
Right.
They had, I think, 6 deaths, and they pulled that drug. Clearly, there have been more suicides, I think 1,000 some, I don't have the exact figure in front of me, regarding psych drugs for suicides. Why haven't they pulled these drugs?
Exactly.
At some point, you have to ask these questions.
Right. And the military, when you look at the military, currently there are it's between 23 and 24 active or veterans commit suicide each and every day, which is over 8,000 a year, and they have a screening process in the military. Well, they have a mental health screening in a lot of places, including in my state. They pass this mental health screening for all school children, all students, and they have also implemented this in the military. And I believe that the reason that they have introduced this screening is so that, well, if you look at the test, the questionnaire, it's just so open-ended. You know, have you ever been sad? Have you ever thought of suicide? Have you ever? And there's no way that you're going to get finished that questionnaire without being diagnosed, because if you answered, no matter how you answered, they would recommend that you see a mental health specialist who is going to put you on a drug. And
right.
I think that's the reason that we have so many suicides in the military, is because they have funneled all of these people through the screening process, and now we have all these suicides. And I think that this is just a small microcosm of the general population.
Well, the screening process is pretty new. In 2012, I think those are the most recent numbers, there were 349 suicides among active duty military personnel, and that's more than were killed in Afghanistan and Iraq in combat.
Mm-hmm.
The veterans killing themselves at a rate of 22 a day. The fact is, if you look at all of the data, what you see is the increase in psychiatric diagnosing. It kind of goes hand in hand with the increase in the drugging.
Yes.
And for some reason, the military doesn't quite get the connection. So I don't know, you know, how else to present it to them other than to go, well, look, this is when you started really diagnosing, and then you see the subsequent drugging, and then you have this many suicides. You know, again, is there a correlation? I certainly think there's definitely a correlation there. The Pentagon is spending, you know, $2 billion a year on mental health. Their budgets are just soaring as far as, you know, the amount of money being poured into drugs and mental health, which consists of basically drugging. In fact, I did a 4-part series, I guess about a year and a half ago, on the military suicides, and I looked at specifically these two cases. One of the young men was a Marine. His name was Andrew White. He had been prescribed a cocktail of drugs. We'll call it that. It's called polypharmacy, but it's a cocktail of mind-altering drugs. And in 1 year, he came back from combat, and in 1 year, he had been prescribed 19 different drugs. Okay. He was found dead in his bed. In other words, he went to bed one night and he just died. He didn't have any physical injuries from being in combat, but he came back, he was depressed, you know, he was having some flashbacks. So he went and he sought mental health. Mental health prescribed him 19 drugs. There's this other case that I looked at, and his name was Tony Mina. He was an airman. He also came back with the same, you know, sort of depressed and having some nightmares, having trouble, you know, reassimilating into a civilian sort of life. They prescribed him 35 drugs over an 18-month period, and he also was found dead in his bed. So we have a problem in the military with the polypharmacy, the cocktail of drugs. And what's interesting is that when you look at these drugs, when they do clinical trials, when pharmaceutical companies do these clinical trials, I can guarantee you there is not one clinical trial available for review where 35 different drugs were all tested together.
No, they only test one.
Okay, so we know now that there's never been a clinical trial to tell us that giving somebody 35 drugs over a one-year period is a good thing.
Right.
Or there's any efficacy whatsoever. But yet, doctors and psychiatrists and mental health have no problem giving our returning service members, and even those who never went into combat.
Exactly, they could just work at the office somewhere.
That's right. They're getting cocktails of mind-altering drugs that have never, ever been in a clinical trial to see how they all work together.
I see the military as a guinea pig population, and because the government is buying, well, they are the biggest customer that the pharmaceutical industry has, and they have a group of people who are under their control, basically.
Well, they're under their control anyway. I mean, when you're in the military,
yes,
you're under the government's control anyway.
Right.
Period.
Exactly.
So when you're ordered, if you come back from combat and you do, you know, you're screened, you have to answer all these questions on a piece of paper, whatever. They say, well, we think you ought to go see a mental health person. We're concerned that you may have, you know, be depressed. They have to do that, okay? And if they're prescribed drugs, I don't think they have to take the drugs. I think they can actually refuse to take the drugs. And again, I can look that up for you. Although I think it's actually in a documentary that I want to talk about, and I think you've seen it. It's put out by the Citizens Commission on Human Rights. It's called
yes.
The Hidden Enemy.
Yes.
It's a documentary.
Yes.
I think they talk about what soldiers are allowed to and not allowed to do when it comes to mental health diagnosing and prescribing of psychiatric drugs towards the end of that documentary. That documentary, and for disclosure purposes, I want to say I am actually interviewed briefly in that documentary.
Yes, yes, you are.
But I think that anybody in the military or their families who want to understand what's going on in the military with the drugging of their loved one, they need to watch this documentary. It is extremely informative, and I think they get a lot out of it. And I'm going to just throw it out there. It's www.cchr.org. Click on that, and the video is there. You can watch it. It's free. But it's really a great documentary.
Absolutely. Yes. And I think that they can legally say they don't want the drug, but how many of them do? How many of them know that that they can?
Exactly. Deanna, you're brilliant. That's perfect. That's exactly what the problem is. How many of them really know the harmful effects of these drugs?
Right.
So they do it. They go, however it's sold to them. Oh, you're suffering from a chemical imbalance, whatever, I don't know. They don't know what's going to happen when they start taking those drugs.
Right. And, of course, this another big term is PTSD, and I believe they made that term up in 1980.
Yeah, that was added, I think, into the DSM-3, post-traumatic stress disorder. Post-traumatic stress disorder, I could have post-traumatic stress disorder if I know somebody who has post-traumatic stress disorder.
Right.
It is so, the diagnosis is so broad. I mean, literally, if you know someone who saw a car accident, you could have PTSD just because you talked to them about how horrific it was. I'm not saying, and again, I want to make it clear to your listeners, I'm not saying that the people who are coming back from combat aren't experiencing some really, really bad emotional and behavioral things. I'm saying that you don't have an abnormality in your brain that is PTSD.
Right.
You may get that diagnosis from the military when you come back, or you may get it from the VA, and they may give you drugs that will, quote-unquote, treat PTSD, but you do not have an abnormality in your brain that is PTSD.
Right. Now, the film says that there are 175 different symptoms or combinations thereof that constitute PTSD. 175
right.
different symptoms.
Right. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's very, very broad.
Exactly.
Who can be diagnosed with PTSD? It's just, anything can constitute PTSD. And if you get this, then, you get drugs. You get mind-altering drugs. So, and that's how the military's mental health seems to appear to be working in today's world. If you're diagnosed with a alleged mental illness, then we have the drug or drugs for you to treat it. And if the first drug doesn't work, we'll try another one. If that doesn't work, we'll put a couple together. Or maybe rather than an antidepressant and a sleep medication, we need to add an antipsychotic. it's a witch's brew. Chemicals.
Right.
Now,
for instance, and you mentioned this too, is that they often give you a drug to treat the side effects of another drug. For instance, they might give you a stimulant, take a stimulant in the morning, but hey, if you can't go to sleep, then take this to help you go to sleep. I mean, it is just all day long. They have a regular, take this at 8 a.m., this one at 10. I mean, it's a wonder people can function at all.
Well, this is true, and when I talked about the two people in the military who I interviewed, their families after they died, they were dead in the bed. That's a real term, dead in the bed. One of the mothers was telling me that she actually was talking to her son when he was in Afghanistan, I believe, and they were on the phone, they were talking, and he stopped, and he said, "Wait a minute, Mom, wait a minute," and he left the phone for a few minutes. Came back, and he said, "Mom, the moon just exploded." Okay?
So, oh, my.
This is a guy who, again, I'm telling you, when you're having trouble in combat over in Afghanistan and Iraq, what we learned was that they were basically just handing out psychiatric drugs. They weren't writing scripts. They were just, handing them out to them. Ambien, this sleep medication, was one of the biggies that they were giving to service people over in a combat situation. And that's got its own set of adverse reactions that go along with it. But you start taking Ambien. And by the way, the Fort Hood shooter, Ivan Lopez, we know that he was taking Ambien, and we know that he had been seeking mental health for other, and they called them other mental health issues, okay, like depression. I guarantee if they were to, release his records, he was on a cocktail of drugs.
Right.
He's just like the classic case of being on a cocktail. He was in a combat zone. He came back. I'm sure he had some difficulties. And what did they do? They gave him, mind-altering drugs. The same with Navy Yard shooter Aaron Alexis.
Right.
He was on antidepressant. I think we see this too often, and we need military to address it. I think in one of my articles I said if they want an army of one, they're getting there.
Sure, and you are. You're terrific, and you just you have just explored this so fully and completely. It's just amazing. But with the military, they have the power to conceal those records. They can conceal all the records. If you look at the court records, there was that 11-year-old and that 13-year-old that I believe they killed 5 people, and they were both on something. But the court said, "No, we're not going to tell you what they were on." The court knows what they were on, but we're not going to reveal it to the public. And I think that's typical.
It is typical. I'm probably saying I'm a lot. trying to think of all the data that I can provide to your listeners. I'm passionate about this issue, and I want people to get the help they need, and I want them to get honest information. We have seen in the past, in 1999, when I wrote my first article, Guns and Doses, what we saw was, Dylan Clay, the Columbine shooters.
Right. Harris.
Yeah, Harris and Claybold. Harris had been on two antidepressants, and I believe Claybold also had been. Also, he was in anger management classes at one point for something that the two of them had done together. And usually that's a sign that there were some sort of drug diagnosing going on or drug prescribing going on. But if you're a minor in one of these school shootings, they don't have to release any of your mental health records. And it's up to the family or friends to sort of talk about that information, to make it public. The courts tend to not release a minor's mental health or medical records.
Hmm.
And it's hard. It makes it difficult to sort of get good data as far as the number of these kids, at least the civilian school shootings. I think David Healy did a study, and Dr. David Healy, I'm sure you know his name.
He's been on my program maybe 3 times. Love his work.
Yeah,
I have his book. Yeah, I have two of his books.
He's a great guy. He's done some really, really good work, and I think he came up with the figure that 90% of the school shooters had been on an antidepressant.
Right.
That's astounding. Who could not say that there's a connection there between violence and psych drugs? The FDA clearly puts black box warnings on antidepressants, and many of these antidepressants aren't even approved for children under 18 still for, the various diagnoses. So we don't really know what the real number is, if the courts would allow that information to come out. But based on the public information that's made available, Dr. Healy came up with 90%. That's a huge number.
Wow. It is. And he has a warning system, too, the RX risk. RISK.net.
I've seen that on Facebook.
Yeah.
And he's doing a lot of work. This is the other thing. I think that even in psychiatry, they're starting to have the white hats and the black hats.
Sure.
That.
Yes, and he's definitely one that has put on a white hat.
Yes, there are several who are there. There's Dr. Bauman, there's Dr. Healy, there's Dr. Bregan, there's Dr. Glenn Mullen. We could go through a whole list. There's a lot of psychiatrists who now are actually, speaking out and saying, hey, not only is this not a biological disease, but these drugs are actually very harmful.
Right. Right. And they really, really are. It is just amazing to me that. And you talked about the black box, and I don't know why people don't look well with any drug. There are side effects to every drug, but particularly one that is going to alter your mind. Then you really need to pay attention to the all of the warnings associated with drugs, and. In fact, I have one doctor on the program on a regular basis, Dr. Daniels, Jennifer Daniels, and she said, drugs are designed, all drugs have they're not even side effects. They are the effects of the drug. And some of those effects will not affect some people, and they will affect someone else. And you never know who it's going to affect. But I think that when patients go to their doctor, they assume that the doctor would never do anything to hurt them. We've all been brainwashed with all of the doctor programs and, that they're gods. I mean, they can fix anything. And and so people believe in their doctor, and they believe that their doctor is not going to give them anything that would be harmful. And I don't think they read the small print. I don't think that they read the black box warnings. There's not enough information in the news, on TV, that talks about this. And there's so much information that counters this. All this TV advertising, even though it says, now you may suffer heart attack, you might suffer death, you might suffer a stroke, they go through this big list. But all the while, they're playing this wonderful music and they have butterflies floating around and people looking happy and riding their bikes through the woods and all kinds of wonderful scenery. And so people aren't listening. But I think, too, that this serves as a public warning so that the court can say, well, you took this, you knowingly took this, and yet we have public warnings on with every commercial that this is what can happen to you, so you took it at your risk. Now, didn't they pass a law saying that you could not, for the states, that you could not sue a drug company for side effects, that it had to go into a federal court?
I don't know anything about that law. I know that's how it is with vaccines.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely.
But I did not know that. I know that, Dr. Bragan testifies in court cases regarding these psychiatric drugs, and he's actually won several.
Yes, which is wonderful. He is so smart.
Yes, and that's really where it's going. It's to the point where it's going to have to end up in the courts, and I think at some point doctors have to be held responsible for their prescribing. Even the military doctors have to be held for their prescribing of these cocktails to our military troops. I mean, really, it's criminal. I just have to say that. I think it's criminal. When you see that these troops are being given 19 and 35 different mind-altering drugs in a year, that's criminal. Somebody is not paying attention to their well-being.
Right. And then the other thing, too, is that if you do have effects, negative effects, adverse reactions, they will say, oh, well, schizophrenia is like that. Oh, well, depression is like that. Never saying, well, the drug is causing this.
Exactly. It's never the drug. It's always their mental illness is worse. Or now they've got bipolar. They started out just being depressed. Okay, now they've got bipolar. It's not because of the drugs that the behavior has changed. I mean, this is the old standby, psychiatry. It's not the drugs, it's your mental illness. It's their fallback. You know how they can't prove that a single mental illness is caused by anything biological? They can't prove that depression is in the brain. Anywhere. ADHD, can't find it, not there.
Right.
But yet they're allowed to tell people this is what you're suffering from.
Sure.
I mean, it's really off the charts. I mean, black box warnings are put on all the antidepressants by the FDA. And this is, by the way, for your listeners if they don't know this is the most serious warning that the FDA can place on a drug, the most serious warning. And so these are on all antidepressants, and they say, they're warning people that they could cause suicidality for a specific age group, and I think right now it's 18 to 24. Think about it. 41% of the people who are deployed are between the ages of 18 and 24, and we have this epidemic of suicides in the military, and nobody seems to think that there is a connection.
I don't know
what to say at that point.
Well, Dr. Bragan testified before Congress. In fact, there's a film. They have a film of it. He testified before Congress a couple of years ago and talked to them about this. I don't see that there's been any change at all. In fact, I think it's probably gotten worse. So you have to, well, Congress, there's that same revolving door in Congress, that the people leave Congress and they step into a plush job, in the pharmaceutical industry or some other corporation.
Right. The thing, it's beyond that, though, now. It's really beyond that. Congress needs to step up to the plate. I wrote in one of my articles not too long ago, I think it was after the Fort Hood shooting, I don't want to hear your condolences anymore. They're not doing any good. You're telling me, this is, lawmakers and the president, whoever, that, our deepest sympathy. We don't want to hear that anymore. It doesn't help. We're not fixing the problem.
Right.
I mean, really, that's where we're at. I don't care anymore that everybody's empathetic. We need to fix this problem, and the only way to fix the problem is to address it. And this is where there may be good news, okay? Congressman Jeff Miller, I have been corresponding with his office on and off since the Navy Yard shooting. He is the chairman of the House Veterans Affairs Committee and recently has said that he's going to hold hearings in June to look into this. There's a petition that I would ask your listeners to sign. And again, it's the petition is up on the Citizens Commission on Human Rights website, cchr.org. And sign this petition because it's asking Congress, it's asking Chairman Miller to hold these hearings, to look into the connection between the psychiatric drugs and the violence in the military.
Right. And a lot of that violence we don't hear anything about. Now, we heard, of course, about the Fort Hood, but we don't hear about some of the other violent things that happen out of this country. And it's not because they're killing the enemy. It's because they are killing randomly because of these drugs.
Right. And again, I mean, I think that the data is there. The data exists that makes it relevant to take a look at it, to sit down and go, okay, let's look at the diagnosis. I mean, seriously, has anyone in Congress ever looked at the diagnosis? Is it biological based? They'll find out it's not. Well, that's important.
Sure, sure.
And then look at the drugs that are used. Look at the warnings that are associated with the drugs. Look at the age group that we're giving these drugs to, in the military specifically. And they wonder why we have this epidemic of suicides with this increase in the drugs that can cause suicide for this age group?
Sure. Just look at cause and effect. I mean, it's very obvious. Very, very obvious.
Go ahead. To you and I. But is it to, why isn't it to other people who are in a position of power to make a difference? We're hoping that if people sign this petition and get on board and sort of force Congress to look at it, maybe we'll get some answers and specifically maybe we'll get some changes to save some lives.
Yes. Getting back to ADHD, on the teachers are now making recommendations, and sometimes, depending on where you live, if your child has been prescribed drugs and you say, no, I'm not going to do that, you can actually lose custody of your children.
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, that is just amazing to me.
That's right. I mean, look at the case, Justina Pelletier in Massachusetts. Are you familiar with that case?
Which case?
Justina Pelletier.
Oh, yes, 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 yes. Oh, and she's been held in a hospital for, what, almost a year?
More than a year.
Oh.
And she's been taken from her family. Why?
Oh.
Because psychiatry says she has a mental illness when, in fact, the family argues that she has a medical illness. Who won that argument? Psychiatry did, even though they cannot prove the diagnosis even exists. I mean, that is how upside down the world has become.
Right.
That is the power of psychiatry and the pharmaceutical industry.
Right. The other case that has come to my attention, too, is, of course, Mark Taylor, where he was, he wrote a book. It was just a very short book.
Right.
Yes. So talk to us about him. I mean, they put him in a mental hospital, put him on all these psych drugs, and he can barely put two sentences together now.
Well, he was shot, I think, seven times?
Yeah.
At Columbine, and he wrote a book about his experience, and he was put on psychiatric drugs, and his life has become a mess, absolutely. And it's a very tragic story because it wasn't bad enough that he had to, you know, be on the receiving end of such a horrific event, but then to have the mental health industry diagnose him and drug him only made it worse.
Absolutely.
You know, ADHD, if you listen to the National Institute of Mental Health, ADHD makes it very clear. Scientists are not sure what causes ADHD. That's a quote off their website. After all these years and millions and millions and millions of kids being diagnosed, I think 11% of the school children are diagnosed with ADHD. Don't know what causes it. We have no idea. Let's just diagnose it. We don't know what causes it. But, hey, it's there. It's real.
Give them codeine for it. Kitty codeine. Isn't that what you called it?
It's cocaine. Not methamphetamine.
Yeah.
It's cocaine. It is the equivalent of cocaine in its effect. It is the equivalent. Mm-hmm. And that's the DEA. The DEA says that. It is a Schedule II drug, the most addictive drug.
Yeah.
And yet every day, parents give their kids the equivalent of cocaine to treat this disorder that the National Institute of Mental Health has no idea what it is.
Yikes.
Other than a child's behavior.
Right.
And that is totally based on a doctor's opinion of your child's behavior. You know, does he raise his hand at a turn in school? Does he wiggle in his chair? Does he not finish his homework? I mean, literally, these are the questions that are asked. That your child is given a mental illness diagnosis.
And there are 16 characteristics, and all you have to do is qualify for, what, 6 or 8 of them? And you've got the
police.
Mm-hmm. And boys seem to get it more than others. Well, because they're more active, more rambunctious. They're just boys. Boys are more rambunctious.
Right. Yes, absolutely. Boys are diagnosed with ADHD much more than girls. And that is because boys have a lot of energy.
Yes.
A lot of energy.
Yes.
That's the whole point behind, I think, recess in elementary school is because you got to get out and wiggle.
Sure, yes.
You know, teachers can't hold, you know, little kids in a room hostage for 8 hours a day without letting them get out and wiggle a little bit.
Absolutely. And some of the, I get wiggly.
Who doesn't?
We all do.
Who doesn't get wiggly? Who likes to sit in one place for hours on end? You can't. I mean, nobody should be expected to do that, especially kids who are growing, okay? And their brains are growing. This is the other thing. I mean, the damage that is done to the brain by bombarding it with all these chemicals, these drugs, you know, it doesn't help the brain. It changes the brain. They have research that shows it actually shrinks the brain.
Oh, yes, by 50%. Isn't it 50% that it will destroy your brain, that children who have taken these drugs as children, it actually destroys their brain and gives them they're not able to function. They're not able to function and make decisions and feel like they can control their life. And so when you're starting by giving an infant or a 2-year-old or 3-year-old, you're destroying that child for the rest of its life.
Sure. And again, you know, there was actually a 2011 study that found that widespread brain atrophy, which is shrinkage, in adult people who had been diagnosed and treated for ADHD as children. Okay, so they found there was atrophy, shrinkage, in the adult people who were children drugged. So, again, these drugs change the chemical makeup of your brain.
Right.
Plain and simple. That's been proven over and over and over again.
Right. Now, I haven't, I've read quite a little bit about autism and vaccines, and I know this is kind of off topic, but in my view, I think that when you give a bunch of vaccines in the same way to little infants who, I mean, you're giving them hepatitis B injections. I mean, that's for sexually transmitted diseases and that kind of thing, and you're giving them, giving an infant that kind of stuff, putting these vaccines, these full of viruses and all these things into their bloodstream, I think that's going to affect their brain. And I think that the minute you do that, you've also got a patient for life, because I believe that autism is caused from vaccines.
A lot of people believe that. I actually wrote about vaccines a lot when I was at the Times Inside Magazine. And what was interesting is talking to parents of kids who were, you know, diagnosed as autistic and so forth. They all said the same thing, that my child was born normal, okay? And that always struck me as very interesting. There was nothing wrong with my child until after they got this, you know, cocktail of vaccines, the MMR or whatever it is. And,
sure.
And I think that what I finally concluded as an adult person, as people were talking to me about vaccines, is that, excuse me, if you're a parent and you want to vaccinate your child and you think that's the right thing to do, fine, do it, but do it one at a time. Don't do more than one vaccine at a time, because if your child were to have an adverse reaction, which is pretty quick, it happens pretty quickly if there is an adverse reaction, there's no way for you to prove which of the vaccines caused it. So the other piece of advice I give parents if they're going to vaccinate their kids is to make sure that it's a single shot, because most of the problem came with thimerosal being put into the vaccine.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And thimerosal now, according to the federal government, is only put into the vaccines which are multi-shot. In other words, when you go to CVS, when they haul the elderly people in there like cattle call for their, you know, their
sure.
flu vaccine, they get it out of one big bottle. You can get like 200 shots out of a bottle. And that's got thimerosal in it. Why? Because when you put the needle in, it's like a, what do you call it, it keeps it clean. I'm trying to think of the word.
Gosh, that's disgusting. Sterile.
Yeah. Yes, it makes it sterile, more or less. So they can put that a needle in and out of that vaccine bottle and get their 200 shots. So when parents go to get their kids their vaccines, I just recommend you insist on a single shot. And, you know, he can show you the box. It's only one shot, and he has to throw the little vial away when he's done. And that way you're guaranteed that there's no thimerosal in that. There's not going to be another shot being taken out of that bottle.
Right.
And there's no need for thimerosal in a vaccine except for that purpose, which is, you know,
sure.
Sterilize the needle.
And it was Eli Lilly that created the thimerosal in, when, 1930 or so?
They did.
Yeah.
You know, I love Eli Lilly.
Oh, I do not like Eli Lilly at all.
No, they also came out with Prozac.
Yep, and they also came up with LSD for the military, for military use in 1953.
That's right.
What a company. What a company.
Yeah.
I have a couple questions from the chat room. What about adults that are diagnosed with ADHD? And did you hear about the guy that invented ADHD who said on his deathbed that he made it up?
Yes, of course. I think that the guy that invented ADHD, yes, he had a deathbed pang of consciousness, whatever you want to call it, saying that it, you know, basically it's not true and it was made up. I don't think we needed him to say that. I think there's never been anything to prove that ADHD is an abnormality in a child's brain or an adult brain. But, you know, so be it. He said it.
Okay.
And as far as ADHD in adults, I would say the same thing I say as children. You know,
prove
to me that you have an abnormality in your brain. Tell your doctor to show you whatever through blood test, urine test, CAT scan, MRI, where your abnormality is.
Exactly.
If you're forgetful, I mean, I forget my keys all the time. You know, do I blurt things out when I'm at conferences? Do I raise my hand out of turn, I guess? You know, does that make me have a mental illness? I don't think so. I think it, you know, means I'm a little passionate maybe.
Yes. Yes, that's it. That's it. You brought up another, what I would call another guinea pig population, and that is people in rest homes. The number of people who are on antipsychotic drugs and antidepressants in rest homes is absolutely amazing.
They are guinea pigs for sure. And I also think that they are a way to control that population. Let me tell you a personal thing, if I can, that happened to me recently. My ex-mother-in-law, who I love dearly, I love her, she's wonderful, she went to the hospital because she was having trouble breathing. And so the doctors there put a trach down her throat. And in today's world, for some reason, and when they do that, they give you a drug called propofol. It's the thing that Michael Jackson died of.
Oh, my.
And so she was kind of out of it. I mean, mentally, she was
sure.
Just like there. So anyway, she got out of that hospital and came home and had more problems. And so they took her to a different hospital. Same thing happened. They gave her drugs, mind-altering drugs. And so when I finally got to see her in the nursing home where she was transferred to, I was blown away. They had written on the board that she had Alzheimer's and dementia. And I tried to talk to her, and she didn't know who I was. She didn't know who her son was, okay? And I couldn't believe it. I was in shock. And obviously, I'm very aware of drugs. And I told the doctor that there's no way that she had dementia, and there's no way that she has Alzheimer's. I just talked to her 2 weeks ago, and she could tell me anything you wanted to know about the stock market.
Exactly. There's nothing wrong with her brain.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with her. I was like, she does not have Alzheimer's, and she does not have dementia. And I finally turned around to my ex-husband, and I said, you got to get her off the drugs they've got her on. That's what's causing this.
Right.
And within 2 weeks, she was back to her old self.
Oh, my gosh. Now, what was
right?
What was the drug that they gave her first at the hospital to?
It's called propofol. It's the drug that Michael Jackson was on when he died.
Okay.
Okay.
I wonder if he died from being on drugs. Well, he died because of drugs.
Yeah, he did die because of drugs. But anyway, I thought that was, in my life, that was really interesting to see my 87-year-old mother-in-law with doctors saying, oh, she has Alzheimer's and dementia. And I'm like, no, she doesn't. No, wrong.
Wow.
You know, and then I finally assert myself with my ex-husband and say, hey, it's the drugs.
Yes.
And as soon as they got her off the drugs, she came back to her old self.
What if you hadn't been there? I hope your ex-husband really appreciates you. And you can tell him I said that.
I don't know. I mean, you know, like we have an okay relationship, but it was like having this knowledge about these drugs and looking at her laying. I mean, she was pathetic. It was absolutely pathetic. She had no idea who we were. Completely.
Bless her heart. Oh, my goodness. That could happen to any older person that goes to the hospital. All they have to do is give them a shot to calm them down or to say it calms them down. And the next thing you know, they're in the rest home.
That's right. That's right. And unless people know to say these things, they're going to keep them on these drugs, and these people don't get any better, okay? They're just zombies, more or less.
Right.
I mean, that's what my mother-in-law was. She couldn't get out of bed. She couldn't walk. She couldn't talk. Nothing.
My
until now, she's up and walking around, and she's fine. She's 87 years old, and she's fine. And yet, the doctor said she had dementia and Alzheimer's. It just went away, I guess.
Yeah, I guess it did. It must have been something magic that happened. I think it's a relationship with getting off the drugs, cause and effect. Pretty obvious.
Well, I mean, that was the only difference in her life in that hospital situation.
Now, what did they put her on in the nursing home? Did they
antidepressants?
Okay.
And I said to my ex, "Your mom's not depressed." You know, she's not. She's a wonderful woman, and totally her mind is good. I think, in any 87, 88, 90-year-old person, they're going to miss words. You know, I don't have a problem with that. They're not thinking as quickly as we are. But this is a woman who could tell you just about anything you wanted to talk about.
Right.
And suddenly she's, you know, a vegetable overnight.
Right. Somebody made a comment in the chat room. This is similar to what happened to my friend's 65-year-old retarded sister. She was in the hospital for a few days, and now she's in diapers, can't walk, can't feed herself, and has to go to a nursing home because she was in the hospital for a few days. And apparently they saw a good target person that they could get on drugs, and, well, bingo, there you go, off to the nursing home.
That's right. And once they get them in the nursing home, they just, you know, it's just a continual drug thing. Unless they have an advocate. And, you know, I can't say this enough. I mean, the elderly who are in hospital situations and who are in, you know, nursing home situations, they need an advocate. They need somebody who knows what these drugs do. They need to ask, what drugs are you giving my mother, my father, my loved one?
Sure. Well, people...
And they don't want to look at it.
Exactly. And when you go to the hospital, you have a right to reject anything. But a lot of people that go to the hospital, it's like they've turned off their brain when they get there, and whatever the doctor or whatever the nurses suggest that they have, they don't say no. They don't reject or refuse anything. You have a right to refuse what the doctor says you should have. He's not in charge of your body. You are.
Right. Absolutely, they have a right to reject it and say no. But again, you have to be an advocate. You have to go home and you have to look up the drugs that they're giving your loved one.
Right.
And you have to go, and then you have to look at the side effects. What are the side effects of this drug?
Okay, let's talk about some of those side effects.
For instance, you know, we know that antidepressants can cause suicidality, mania, psychosis, hallucinations. And by the way, my mother-in-law was totally hallucinating when she was in this nursing home.
That's an indication of over-drugging?
It was to me right away. I mean, I was lucky enough to see her, you know, 2 weeks before.
Mm-hmm.
To see, oh, this is a woman that's in great shape. She's fine. We had a lucid conversation about a zillion things, even, you know, things that happened 25 years ago. And then 2 weeks later, she's a vegetable, literally. She's, you know, kumquat in the bed. She doesn't know who I am. She doesn't know who her son is. She's hallucinating verbally about, things that were like, whoa. So to me, it was totally drug-induced. I had no doubt about it.
Wow.
And as soon as she was stopped being drugged, then she got better, and she no longer has Alzheimer's, and she no longer has dementia.
Right.
And she's home. She's home, you know, eating, drinking, sleeping, whatever. You know, I mean, everything is fine. She's not dependent on somebody to feed her like she was in the nursing home or change her or whatever.
Right.
I'm just saying, you know, as a personal, I mean, this was such a personal thing to see that, and I was so angry at the time because I love her, that I was just going to speak up. I didn't have any, you know, decision-making power there, but, you know, luckily,
sure.
My ex was willing to listen.
Right. Now, Chapter 5, you talk about school shooters. Mm-hmm. And your subtitle is, Were They Doped Into Killing? And then the first story that you have is Jeff Wise, who was American Indian, and he went to school at the Red Lake High School on Red Lake Indian Reservation in northern Minnesota. He was 16 mm-hmm. years old. He fired 13 shots in the home of his grandfather, killing him and his grandfather's girlfriend. And then he went to the school, and in less than 10 minutes, with 45 gunshots, he killed, at the end of the day, 10 people, including the shooter, were dead. Seven others were wounded, and a nation watched in horror, again wondering why.
Right. Right. I mean, again, you have to look at it. Here are, you know, very young minds who were diagnosed with something and got prescribed mind-altering drugs that, by the way, at that time were not approved by the FDA for treatment. And I would suggest that this young man had one of the known adverse reactions.
Right. And that is killing and suicide are side effects of these drugs. And he was taking 3 20-milligram pills a day. What was he? He was on Prozac, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was on Prozac.
Okay.
Anxiety, insomnia, agitation, amnesia, confusion, depression, hallucinations, hostility, paranoid reactions, psychosis, delusions, neurosis, suicide attempt, acute brain syndrome. I mean, these are all known adverse reactions.
That's all to Prozac. There's something that Dr. Bregan talks about. He talks about, I don't even know whether I can say it, it's akathisia.
Akathisia. Right.
Tell us about that.
That is a real abnormality that is actually caused by SSRIs.
Okay. And what are the symptoms? What do people do that have this or that develop it as a result of taking drugs?
You know, I don't have that in front of me, what akathisia causes, but it is, and it has been proven, that it is caused, and also tardive dyskinesia is also caused by SSRI drugs.
Okay. Dr. Bregan
goes into it a lot in his books.
There's
a lot of information he provides about those two things.
Now, what he said was that it causes people to want to move around, particularly their legs, want to move around unceasingly. They have all this motor, you know, especially in their legs, and that they often find activities that they can do this with. And sometimes just people in rest homes who develop this, they will literally wear out the carpet under their feet. They will wear out the soles of their shoes just by moving their legs. And it seems to affect the legs more than any other part of the body, that they just have to keep moving their legs.
Yes. I've heard it also explained as they feel like they've got bugs on them, you know, like they're itching and it's like a constant, you know, they can't, eye movements, their tongue sort of hangs out of their mouth. I mean, he goes into a great more detail than I can. I've never really gone into great study about either tardive dyskinesia or the other. But, yeah, it's caused by SSRIs.
Wow. Now, you have studied Adam Lanza, and I believe that I read that you said that he'd been on SSRIs, or at least under medication, since the age of 10. Did you say that, or did I imagine?
Adam Lanza, what we know and what we don't know about Adam Lanza is like night and day. okay? And that's really a shame based on the fact, first of all, the tragedy itself and the victims, but more so down the road because you look at what has transpired after the shooting at Sandy Hook. We have 37 states that have implemented increased mental health services because of that shooting. And I, you know, I look at that shooting and it's important to me for that reason from a mental health standpoint. What they are saying is that in passing this legislation, basically saying, oh, we need more mental health. You know, if Adam Lanza had more mental health, he wouldn't have done this.
Right.
So we have to, you know, we have to act. And, of course, you know, I spent almost 20 years working in Congress, and to me it was, you know, sort of a crisis management kind of thing when they did it. But the thing is, we don't know the last 5 years of Adam Lanza's mental health and medical records.
Right.
Nothing was provided in that investigation about those last 5 years, which is odd. It's terribly odd. He wasn't a minor. This is no. This is not a problem with the HIPAA rules. You know, a dead person basically doesn't have any rights, frankly. So exactly. Why they didn't release this information is astounding. His father made it available to the police and the FBI. The documents were pulled from the Lanza home, which is part of the record in the investigation. So they have all those records. Even the school records were subpoenaed. Dr. Fox, who was Adam Lanza's psychiatrist, he was basically, he lost his license to practice medicine in 2012 because he was having sexual relations with his patient. He says that he destroyed his record,
right,
of treating Adam Lanza. And I got to tell you, I think he's somebody that if I were investigating Sandy Hook, I mean really investigating it, I'd be looking at him very closely. His first response in the media was that he seems to recall Adam Lanza. Well,
yeah.
Here, he was his primary psychiatrist
exactly. For
a while. Okay, he dealt with Adam for a while. So he more than recalls Adam. He knows Adam.
Right.
And Nancy Lanza, through this documentation that I found in the investigative report, seems like a mother who was very involved in her son's mental health, constantly trying to get him help, and even, you know, communicating with all the doctors through emails or in person, whatever. Adam was treated, that we know, the last treatment that we know he got was in 2007 at the Yale Child Study Center, where they gave him Celexa, which is an antidepressant.
Right.
And he had an adverse reaction. Nancy Lanza immediately reported an adverse reaction to the supervising nurse, her name is Kathleen Koenig.
Yeah.
And basically, this nurse, I think it's fair to say, she pretty much blew Nancy Lanza off.
Yes, you know, she was non-compliant.
She said that Nancy Lanza was non-compliant because Nancy Lanza said, I'm going to take him off of it. Okay?
Right.
And this is kind of a standard mental, I can see this is standard mental health. No, the drug. And she says to Nancy Lanza, this is what's really, and she says, oh, no, it couldn't be the drug.
Right. Right.
When in fact, when you look up the adverse reactions to Celexa, everything Nancy Lanza was telling this nurse was absolutely underneath the list of adverse reactions.
Right.
So it wasn't Nancy Lanza that was wrong. It was the nurse who was wrong.
Right.
And then we found out in the article that was done by Andrew Solomon in the New Yorker magazine that Adam had been prescribed another antidepressant. And there seems to be some conflict there because he says in his article that the antidepressant that he was given was the last antidepressant that Adam took.
I don't believe that. Lexapro.
Lexapro, exactly. And I find that odd because what he didn't do, what Andrew Solomon didn't do in that article, he didn't say when Adam was taking the Lexapro. So
right.
that would have been helpful. Because obviously, I'm assuming Peter Lanza gave Andrew Solomon this information because it's not part of the police record.
Right.
So we know now that Adam was at least on Lexapro and Celexa.
Right.
So that's two antidepressants. That's all we know. We don't know anything after 2007. And I find that odd. Why is the public not allowed to know what mental health he received in the last 5 years of his life?
Right. That's why I asked about the akathisia, because Adam Lanza participated in a game called Dance Dance Revolution at the theater from Friday through Sunday. He would go to the theater for up to 10 hours.
Yes.
Plus, he had the home version of that game. So what I am wondering, was that a side effect of the drug that he was taking? And he was doing this right up to the time of the event.
That's right, November of 2012. Uh-huh.
Yes, yes. So I'm kind of thinking that this is a side effect of the drug. I mean, I don't know of anybody that would go and play Dance Dance Revolution for 10 hours at a time.
Well, again, look, his diagnosis was Asperger's and OCD, obsessive-compulsive disorder.
Right.
Okay. So, there's so many questions of the investigation. I think that I hardly even like to call it an investigation. It seems like it's just kind of a summary of what everybody thinks happened. We're not entitled to see any of the names of the people involved. We're not entitled to see the original documents. You know, the public basically just got a summary of what the state police think happened. And I find that irritating. I think we're all entitled to read all the information.
Mm-hmm.
This happens so often, though, in these investigations that it's a major clampdown. It doesn't mean, though, that there aren't discrepancies. I found several discrepancies in that investigation already.
Oh, I did, too. I did, too. I mean, but that's just people making mistakes.
Well, it may be and it may not be. And, I don't know where the trail leads. But the thing is that we don't know enough about Adam Lanza's mental health. I mean, he may have been getting the best mental health available.
Yes.
Think about it that way. We don't know. He may have had great mental health.
Yeah.
And what is that? What if he had great mental health and actually it was the mental health that caused it?
Yes. The other thing, too, is that they said right away, now his autopsy was performed on the 15th, and they said there's no evidence of drugs in his body. But a toxicology report requires sometimes as long as 3 months to conduct. So how could they give that information and say there were no drugs in his body when a toxicology report requires much, much longer than a couple of hours to?
Well, that information didn't come out for a while. Okay, I understand that. But my bigger question is, again, why are we hiding the autopsy report? What is the big secret? And as a matter of fact, I'm sure if you've read the investigation, the police investigation, you saw that Peter Lanza signed off to
in
make
March.
That public.
Yes, in March.
Okay. Of 2013.
Yeah.
Why has that not made public? And again, you know, there's lots of questions going on here. They say that he committed suicide. And it's interesting the way that the medical examiner put this. He said, you know, gunshot wound to the head was due to suicide. Well, I've read lots of autopsies, and usually the way that's written is gunshot wound to the head, self-inflicted.
Right.
Okay? So, I mean, I think that's kind of an interesting, you know, kind of twist on how they've decided it's suicide rather than self-inflicted. And these are just little things that kind of pop out at you. But again, the fact is, why is the public not allowed to see the autopsy report, the full autopsy report? It will determine, it would reveal how close the gun was to Adam Lanza's head. okay? There'd be stippling, there'd be powder if it was right up against his head, okay?
Yeah.
I mean, there's all these questions that go with this, and we're not entitled to see that. We're not entitled to see anything specific in this report. I mean, it is so redacted. Thing is redacted out of this report. It's actually irritating to go through this to try and
it
find.
It is, because then you flip the page, you know, and you think, oh, the next page, it'll have the information in the next page, and it's totally redacted.
Right. I mean, how about the telephone use of Adam Lanza? He had a cell phone. His mother had a cell phone. Why can't we see if they talked to each other in the last 3 days since she went to New Hampshire?
Right.
How long were those conversations? Did they email each other? There's nothing in this report about any contact between Nancy Lanza and Adam Lanza.
Yeah.
And that is odd, because the day before she left, Adam bumped his head and he was bleeding.
Right.
Now, a mother who cares this much about her son absolutely puts off her trip for an entire day because of Adam's wound, whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
Then the next morning gets in the car, drives away for 2 days, and never bothers to check in to see if he's okay?
Yeah.
I mean, I want to know.
Yeah.
So why are we not entitled to see all that? I just don't get it. And we know that they have it. It's listed there, that they have all their cell phones, they have all their computers, they have all their documents.
Yeah. There's another thing about this school shooting, too, is that most of the school shootings occur with the shooter going to the school that he is attending. This was different. This was a former student going in.
Yeah, a real former student, a long-time former student.
Yes.
I don't know how to answer that, again, because there's so little information that's been provided.
Sure.
You know, there's also information that was gleaned from his Garmin. Are you familiar with that?
From his who?
His Garmin.
No.
He could put his car and it would help him find where he was going.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah.
Okay. So what's interesting about the Garmin, I think, and certainly it raises questions to me, is that, you know, they've painted him as sort of an introvert, never wanted to leave the house.
But that's not true.
He didn't have any friends. And in fact, if you look at his Garmin, this kid gets out more than I do, okay?
Yeah, more than me. And in the middle of the night. Where's he going in the middle of the night?
Not only in the middle of the night, but he's out until 5:30 in the morning every night.
Yeah. Where is he? Where's he going?
So again, this is stuff that you go, wait a minute, well, I don't understand this. They're telling me he was somebody who, you know, he didn't have any friends. Well, now we find out he had friends at the movie theater that he talked to online. You know, I mean, this kid was a pretty active kid.
Yes.
So I don't know. I don't know what, as I said at the beginning, there's so many questions about this investigation. I hate to call it an investigation.
Yes.
It's a summary. I mean, that's all
right.
I can say.
I think they investigated. It's just that they are not divulging what's in it. But is that any different than the Columbine or other? You know, I never looked at all the papers at Columbine. I didn't look at any of those papers. But is it any different than that investigation?
I never looked at the investigation of Columbine.
Yeah, it's
all I looked into was the mental health end of it.
Yeah.
And again, in this case, the most important part of this case is the mental health part of it.
Exactly.
And that's the 5 years that's missing.
Yeah.
5 years of his life has been extracted. And the most important 5 years, I might add.
Right.
Because that leads up to the shooting. The 5 years leading up to the shooting, there's nothing.
Right.
We have no idea what he was being treated with as far as drugs. Was he part of an experimental program? I don't know, because we don't have any documents.
Right. But we do know that he was on at least two drugs, and his father said he never took another drug after that, which would be after 2007. I don't believe that. I do not believe that for 1 minute.
Frankly, I don't either. But again, until you can see the records, I guess the other thing that I don't believe is the report sort of wants us to believe that Nancy Lanza just stopped. You know,
yeah.
That was the end of it. No more mental health after 2007. And this
right.
is a woman who, from 5 years old, was like totally involved in getting him help.
Right.
And so this report wants us to believe that in 2007, after his sojourn to, you know, the Yale Child Study Center, that she just went, I'm done.
Yeah.
I don't believe that.
Yeah. I don't believe that either. And in as much as he did go to a psychiatrist, and he was also seen by Dr. King.
At Yale Child Study Center, right.
Yes. Who
and, and what's interesting, here, Dr. Fox is an interesting guy. He's a very interesting guy. He destroyed his records, okay, early, by the way. He was supposed to hold those for 7 years
yes.
in Connecticut.
Yes, legally. Mm-hmm.
Right, and 6 years in New York. He didn't. He got rid of them at 5 years, right before the shooting. So that's sort of interesting to me. But we have Abel Child wrote an article about another patient of Dr. Fox who was on 10 different mind-altering drugs.
Right, right. As a 10-year-old.
That's right.
Yes.
So you've got to wonder, was Adam being treated the same way?
Yeah. Yeah, I think he probably
was. And is that why we don't get to see his records from Dr. Fox, who now lives in New Zealand? I mean, what are the odds of this guy leaving 6 months before the shooting, destroying his records, and moving to New Zealand?
Yes. Exactly.
But anyway, it's something that you look at and you go, well, I'd sure like to know what his mental health record would reveal for those 5 years.
Sure, sure.
Apparently, none of the states who have passed all this mental health legislation to increase mental health, services seem to care. They all passed it without having any information to support the fact that there was a need for it.
Exactly, exactly. And not only that, but Obama gives Connecticut $100 million to have more mental health.
Exactly, and it's all based on nothing. I mean, I'm
yeah.
sorry, it's,
yeah.
it's sort of idiotic. We don't even know if any more mental health is needed. In fact, I would argue that maybe the mental health he got wasn't very good.
Right.
Okay?
Yes.
Let's look at what he's got.
Yes.
Then we can make some decisions.
And even if after 2007, if he didn't take any more psychiatric drugs, which they would lead us to believe that was the case, he was still on enough drugs that it probably permanently damaged his thinking capacity.
Then that's a possibility. We know that these drugs cause damage to the brain.
Right.
So that's a very real possibility. But unless they release this information, it's just a big question mark. And that's unfortunate. Because
yes.
this legislation affects more people. More people are going to be diagnosed and more people are going to be drugged. It's a never-ending cycle.
Indeed. Well, it has been wonderful having you on the program. We could talk about this we could talk every day about this.
We could.
So thank you so very much. I didn't even give you a break. I'm sorry. But
that's okay.
Thank you so much for being on the program. I hope that we can do this again.
I'd love to, Deanna. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you so very, very much. And keep up the good work and keep working.
Thank you.
All righty. Take care.